Welcome back to the program. The idea of a new modern religion is a little confusing on its face, especially one that claims 4.5 million converts each year and that has focused its attention on money and Hollywood. Perhaps Bill Maher tries to explain it best. Let's listen.
Well, every religion has a creation myth. You know what the Scientology creation myth is? They think that 12 trillion years ago, a time frame no scientist believe exists, but okay. 12 trillion years ago, a galactic warrior named Xenu was looking to depopulate his planet, so he took all the souls to Earth, buried them under volcanoes, and blew them up later with atom bombs. Now, just for a moment, imagine the balls it takes to stand in front of another human being and tell them what happened 12 trillion years ago. And I don't mean in general terms, like the planets were cooling. I mean he knows the dude's name. Xenu. Oh, yeah, that cat. From 12 trillion? Yes, of course, Xenu. I mean, if someone tells you this story, the only logical response is to say, well, I guess anything's possible. And then backpedal while maintaining a smile and dialing 911 in your pocket, because that's crazy.
Today, Lawrence Wright, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Looming Tower, about the history of Al-Qaeda, has taken a new look at another religion gone off the rails. It is my pleasure to welcome Lawrence Wright back to this program to talk about his new book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Lawrence Wright, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here, and certainly Bill Maher may have taken some license with that, but there is this odd aspect to the creation myth of Scientology. And in fact, you begin the book talking about Paul Haggis, who L. Ron Hubbard meets out in the desert, and later on it's really when Haggis gets a look at some of this mythology that really he begins to run for the hills.
Well, many Scientologists are told not to look at critical articles or programs because it will just confuse them. And the truth is, very few of them do. You know, it's really surprising to me how obedient mainstream Scientologists can be about this particular directive. So, that, you know, the kids that grow up in Scientology, they can go through most of their life not really hearing critical words about their religion.
Has that changed today, or is this that still the case?
It's still the case. And, you know, I'm surprised. For instance, I've been in communication with some Scientologists since my book came out, and they're very critical of it, but they won't read it. So it's very frustrating to me that, you know, they're willing to take a stand in favor of defending their church, and I don't mind that. But I don't think it's, you know, it's not a real argument unless you're going to look at what the other people are saying about your religion, especially, you know, the alleged abuses going on inside the church.
Is Scientology really a religion?
Well, you know, you and I can talk about that, Jeff, but the only opinion that matters is that of the IRS. And they made their determination in 1993 that Scientology was a religious community. Of course, they did that in the face of the fact that Scientology had launched more than 2,300 lawsuits against the IRS and individual members and had private investigators following agents around, seeing who was drinking too much or fooling around on the road. And part of the deal, whatever the merits of the case, part of the deal was that those lawsuits would be dropped, the private investigators would be called off, and Scientology, which at one point owed $1 billion in back taxes, would be granted a tax exemption. And now that's the only reason that Scientology exists today.
It's interesting to look at the financial history of Scientology because it grew out of the thing called Dianetics, which gave way to Scientology because he lost Dianetics and almost went bankrupt.
That's right. You know, Dianetics was a book that Hubbard wrote in 1950, and it was incredibly popular. It dominated the New York Times bestseller list for a long time, and it was in some ways the precursor of the whole category of self-help books that became so popular after World War II. And Hubbard became very wealthy because of, but he lost all that money. He even lost the name, control of the name Dianetics. And, so he started a new organization. This time he started a religion. He recognized that, religion was, for one thing, you know, the much more solid financial investment than this kind of self-help therapy that really spread around like a hula hoop, you know, in terms of popularity. But once that happened, there was no more need for him. The religion goes on and on forever. You know, you're selling salvation, and that's something that people will always buy.
Talk a little bit about the connection to Hollywood, because from early on you talk about Hubbard being fascinated by Hollywood. He wanted to be a screenwriter. In fact, at one point he envisioned himself as a kind of modern-day Cecil B. DeMille.
Yeah, you know, Hubbard was always drawn to Hollywood, and he started his Church of Scientology in Los Angeles in 1954, and then later created the Celebrity Center in Hollywood. Early on, the church published a list of prospective celebrities that they wanted to recruit into the church who would act as their kind of front men, their celebrity pitch men. And these names included Bob Hope, Walt Disney, Marlena Dietrich, Howard Hughes. I mean, some of the most famous people in the world. And they never were able to get those people in, but they did recruit you know, like Gloria Swanson, who was a silent movie star, and Rock Hudson actually came into Scientology for a brief period of time. There were, you know, but they were always looking for that exemplary figure that would help Scientology, as Hubbard said, take over the entire entertainment industry.
Wasn't Hubbard also looking for someone that could really help him in terms of his career?
Well, he, you know, certainly I think he wanted to be acknowledged as a force in Hollywood, and he was writing screenplays. He never got anywhere with that, but he created his own movie studio in this desert compound that the church maintains in Southern California. Mainly what he did there was to make training films for the Church of Scientology, but His dream of being a successful screenwriter and director never was materialized.
Talk about what Scientology represented as a set of ideas. I mean, you talk about this key idea of the reactive mind versus the analytical mind.
Well, in Hubbard's diagnosis, this was in Dianetics, you have two minds inside you. One is the analytical, rational mind, and it's like a perfect computer. It never forgets anything. And the other mind is this irrational, reactive mind. It's where all of our fears and neuroses are buried. And the reason they're there is because of experiences that we've had in this lifetime or in previous ones that tend to control our behavior. In Dianetics, the term is engram, and engram is an experience fully remembered in every detail that is still buried inside your consciousness. A good example is John Brody, who was the great quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers. He had a shoulder injury and wasn't able to be cured. And he went to a Dianetic counselor, and the counselor got him to remember an event when he was, years before, when he had crashed into a tree in his car and had been knocked unconscious and had broken his arm. And during the counseling, Brody claimed to remember that while he was unconscious, the ambulance attendant said, "This poor guy will never throw the ball again." And he said, "I can't remember that because I was unconscious." And the counselor said, "That doesn't matter. Every single thing that you said or did or experienced is completely alive inside your reactive mind. And you bring all those details up. Again, you drain them of their ability to affect your behavior, and eventually this will all go out of your body. And in fact, John Brody went on to become the most valuable player that year. So that's an example of how Dianetics is supposed to work, by clearing the reactive mind of those kinds of experiences.
And this idea of clearing the reactive mind, clearing the negative energy, really is the core principle here.
Yeah, the idea is that when you've done that, when you've taken all those experiences out of your reactive mind, you've eliminated the reactive mind, and then you have achieved a state of clear. In that state, you know, it's like a superheroic state, because you are, your reactions are faster, your intelligence is higher, even your eyesight is better, you're invulnerable to diseases. You know, you've really achieved a state that, you know, kind of above that of normal human beings. And that's just the base camp for the spiritual pyramid of Scientology.
What do therapists think of some of these ideas?
Well, when Hubbard wrote Dianetics in 1950, he sent the manuscript off to the American Psychological and American Psychiatric Associations with the idea that they would acclaim it as a work of genius. And, of course, they looked at it as psychological folk art. They just could not make heads or tails of it, because he was writing about studies, for instance, that were never actually undertaken, that proved points that he was trying to make in the book. They didn't know how to evaluate it, and it didn't make any sense to them. So it was ridiculed by the professionals. And Hubbard never forgave the psychiatric profession for that. Ever since then, in his view of the world, psychiatrists are at the root of all of our problems, whether it's disease or plague or terrorism or war, pestilence. Everything that is wrong with the world is the fault of psychiatry.
How did Scientology draw people into its fold? I mean, it was, for a while, it was part of the self-help movement, the recovery movement, even the New Age movement.
Well, Scientology offers people courses and auditing, which is a kind of therapy. These are the two things that people come into Scientology for originally. If you walk into a Scientology church, or if you take a personality test that might be offered in the subway station or something like that by a group of Scientologists, what they will do is ask you, what is ruining your life? What is standing in the way of your economic, emotional, spiritual progress? And, you know, everybody has something that they would like to improve in their life. So Scientology offers a menu of courses that can actually help people on many occasions. For instance, Jerry Seinfeld took a communications course in Scientology, and he still credits it for helping him become a stand-up comic. And then there's the auditing that Scientology offers, which is like therapy, but the difference is that between you and your auditor, there is what is called an e-meter. It's like one-third of a lie detector. It's two metal cans that you hold in your hand. Small current, electrical current, runs through it, and the auditor is able to look at a meter and see that, you know, whether you're registering thoughts or emotions. According to Scientology, this is what it measures, is the mass of your thoughts. And this can be very powerful. Imagine being, you know, in a therapeutic situation with a lie detector. It's a completely different relationship. And in the course of that, a lot of people in Scientology discover that they've lived before. If you can imagine, the therapist might say, "What was that thought that just went through your mind?" You know, he detects something. something because of the movement of a needle. And you might say, well, I just had a picture of a farmhouse. Well, go back into that farmhouse and take a look around. Open the door and see what you see outside. Well, it looks like 17th century England. So the idea is that this fantasy becomes enlarged into what a person thinks is a real memory of another lifetime. And there is the e-meter validating it, saying this is real. Well, that's exciting news to a lot of people because it means that they've lived before, they'll live again. They're immortal. And this is one of the primary messages of Scientology, that you are not your body or your mind. You are an immortal spirit called a Thetan.
And how did Scientology transform from these kind of pop psychology ideas into something where there are secret levels and that you have to kind of pay as you go up these secret levels as more is revealed to you?
Well, as Hubbard was elaborating this whole cosmology and this elaborate bureaucracy that supports Scientology, he created these levels what he called operating Thetan. These are levels above the level clear, which is something you achieve in Dianetics. And each of these, now there are 8 levels of operating Thetan, is supposed to take you up this ladder of enlightenment and award you certain superhuman powers. The ability to affect materials just by using your mind, or change, to help people heal, for instance, and things like that that are like other religions in some respects, but are formalized in Scientology in these things called operating Thetan levels.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, it's a very expensive course. Just to get to the top of the pyramid, in terms of how much it costs to get up to operating Thetan 8, it might cost you as much as $500,000. And then on top of that, you'll be paying for auditing, which can be very expensive as well. You'll buy the e-meter. You'll buy all the works of L. Ron Hubbard. And then you'll be asked again and again to contribute to the International Association of Scientologists and to the building funds and so on. So it's not uncommon to find that, people who have climbed all the way to the apex have spent millions of dollars in Scientology.
Certainly, as you alluded to before, it is not something that people leave easily. Go back, talk about Paul Haggis, who you start this story with, who's a Hollywood producer and writer, who gets involved in Scientology, and finally there's a defining event that really transforms his attitude about it.
Paul was a young man in London, Ontario, when he first ran into Scientology. At that time, there were probably only a handful of Scientologists in the whole province of Ontario. But he was intrigued, and he, like a lot of people, he went into Scientology because he had a personal problem he wanted to deal with. In his case, he was having problems with his girlfriend and their relationship. So the two of them went into Scientology together, and they took courses, and he did feel that their relationship was helped. Soon they moved to Los Angeles, where Paul started his career, but also to be closer to the headquarters of Scientology. And they became very involved in the Scientology community. Their children went to Scientology schools. One of Paul's sisters joined the Sea Org, which is the Scientology clergy. And Paul got some of his early jobs through the church, through the connections that he made there. He eventually became an incredibly successful screenwriter and director. His movie Crash, that he wrote and directed, won the Academy Award for Best Picture, and he also wrote the very next year the Academy Award-winning Million Dollar Baby. So, you know, this is a person who had really climbed to the top of Hollywood's success ladder. And he had been in the church for 34 years when Proposition 6, the anti-gay marriage.
Proposition 8, right.
Proposition 8, thank you. When Proposition 8 came along, one of Paul's daughters noticed that a branch of the Church of Scientology had endorsed it. And Paul has two gay daughters, and he was outraged by this, and he asked the church to, you know, to rescind that and actually come out in favor of opposing Proposition 8. But the church wouldn't do that, and so Paul began to look around at some of the information very publicly available about the practices going on inside the church, the abuses alleged by many former members, and some of its history. And what I want to stress about this is this was very unusual. Scientologists are discouraged from looking at information that's critical of their church. And the fact that Paul conducted his own investigation and came to the conclusion that Scientology was not for him and was actually committing offenses that he did not approve, that was really, really unusual.
Why did it take him so long? I mean, the Prop 8 issue was kind of the defining catalyst for him, but didn't he have these concerns earlier?
You know, he was troubled by some of these things, but, you know, characteristically, he just put them out of his mind. It was, for him, it was more important to support the church than to look at critical information. And, you know, I found this true of a lot of people in Scientology who have, many of them have left now, but, you know, they spent many, you know, they had incentives to stay inside the church. One of them was, you know, their friends or family. They were all members of the Church of Scientology. And if you were to leave Scientology, you put that, those relationships at risk. Oftentimes, if you pull out of Scientology, you would be declared a suppressive person, which means that other people in Scientology are forbidden to talk to you. And those may be the people that you are closest to in your life. Another thing is people have invested a lot of money in Scientology, and it's hard to say to yourself that was a mistake. Those people who are in the clergy, the Sea Org, many of them, you know, join as children, and they're impoverished by their service, and they sacrifice their education, and they don't really have a very promising future outside of the church. So there are a number of reasons why people stay in the church and suppress those doubts.
Is it surprising, as you look at everything you learned about it, Lawrence, that Scientology has lasted as long as it has?
Yeah, I agree. It is, you know, Scientology wouldn't exist if they hadn't gotten the tax exemption. But once they did that, this was a turning point in the history of the church. They were allowed, you know, they could own property that they don't have to pay taxes on. They had the stamp of approval of the American government as a religion, and that made a big difference in terms of its standing in the world. The government, U.S. government, actually lobbies in favor of Scientology in certain countries where Scientologists say they're discriminated against. The other thing is that they began a very effective campaign of raising money. And now former executives say that the church has $1 billion in liquid assets, mostly in offshore accounts. And they also have an impressive core of lawyers to defend its interests. What I think Scientology is really suffering from right now is its membership. Although it claims 8 to 10 million members worldwide, the polls show that the number of Scientologists in the United States, the number of people who identify themselves as Scientologists in the U.S., is only 25,000. and the number of people who are members of the International Association of Scientologists worldwide is only about 30,000. So it's, you know, I don't know which of these numbers is more true, the 10 million or the 30,000. But if it's 30,000, then obviously the church is really, really suffering from its membership.
I want to talk about the lawyers, because for a long time people were very afraid to criticize, to take on Scientology. That seems to have changed. You don't seem to be concerned about it. Others have written about Scientology and not been concerned about it of late. And one of the other aspects of this declining membership is the degree to which the transparency of information today makes so much more of this information available.
Well, that's a good point, Jeff. I think that, you know, Scientology does have a history of being litigious and vindictive towards its critics and defectors and reporters. A long history of suing and harassing people, and I want to say I have not been harassed by the church. It's certainly true that we've gotten a number of stern legal letters and threats, but you know, so far I have not been sued, and. Yet, the chilling effect that the church casts by having these very public, harassing lawsuits, and because of the way that it's treated former members and so on, I think it has had the effect of scaring people off from criticizing the church, and that chilling effect still lingers. Previous reporters have been, you know, they say they've been framed for crimes they didn't commit. Paulette Cooper, of course, was one of the very early critics of the church, and she was framed for making bomb threats against the church and was actually indicted. And it wasn't until the FBI raided the church headquarters in 1977, and found a file called Operation Freakout. They discovered this has been a campaign by the church to have Paulette Cooper incarcerated or locked up in a mental institution. The church had sued Time magazine after an expose in the early 90s. Time magazine won at every step of the way, all the way up to the Supreme Court, but it was the most expensive suit they ever defended. So those things, I think, did have a very chilling effect on the press.
Hubbard died back in 86, 27 years ago. Who runs the church today? Who is its guiding principal and guiding leader in terms of both Scientology and the financial aspect of the church?
There's only one person that runs the Church of Scientology, and that is David Miscavige, who took over the church at the age of 25 after Hubbard died. He was not the designated successor. He pushed the designated successors aside and seized control for himself. So when I say that there's only one person running it, the reason I can say that with some assurance is that the other top executives in the church, many of them have left the church now, but they say that he has physically assaulted them, and many of them complained that they were involuntarily confined in re-education camps, sometimes for years on end. So anybody who has that kind of power over his church is the sole ruler of this organization.
Lawrence Wright, his book is Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. And you have a play that is opening here in the Bay Area at Berkeley Rep, the 8th of March, about the late journalist Oriana Fallaci. Tell us briefly about that, Lawrence.
Well, Oriana Fallaci was, in her era, especially in the 60s and 70s, the most famous journalist of her time. And many people remember that she was the first Westerner to interview the Ayatollah Khomeini after the Persian Revolution. I was very affected by Oriana when I was a young man. She made journalism appealing, sexy, powerful. It was, you know, she was a compelling, amazing personality, a tiny Italian woman who would bring, you know, world leaders to heel. She was a real force. And one of the surprising things is that, you know, world leaders would allow her to interview them, even though they knew that, you know, it was a very dangerous procedure. There's no telling what they might say despite themselves.
And that really was the most amazing thing about her, is that people were afraid to talk to her, but they were even more afraid to not talk to her.
You know, it was like a mark of, you know, if you had risen so high in the world that Oriana Fallaci would take notice of you, then, you know, that was a mark of distinction. And so she would interview these world leaders. You know, Henry Kissinger, for instance, says that talking to her was the biggest mistake he ever made in public life. You know, she could absolutely humble these people. And, you know, she came along before the women's movement. So seeing a woman like that, you know, on the public stage was really phenomenal. Then after 9/11, when she had been pretty much hiding out in obscurity in her Upper East Side brownstone for more than a decade, she wrote several anti-Muslim screeds that became very important, especially in Europe, in defining the kind of anti-Muslim hysteria that took root there. So the play is, to some extent, my examination of who this woman was and what she stood for. And it's a kind of argument that I have with her about who she is and what she's accomplished.
Lawrence Wright, his play Fallaci opens at Berkeley Rep on the 8th of March. It's there through April 21st. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his book is Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Lawrence, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.